Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or a favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, they are archived on our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. Thanks. Now let's get started. This time we're going to be talking about the consequences of our decisions and actions and our consensus building and our successful outcome. And we have to think about that. We have to visualize what's going to happen in the real world. Because we live in the real world, and sometimes there are unintended consequences, and we have to think about that. We have to think about what's really going to happen, and if that happens, what'll happen? We have to visualize it. So, as we often do on this show, let's start out by asking a base question, and then we'll get the ideas of what we'd like to talk about, since this is unscripted and depends on you. And I see there's lots of people. Thank you all for being here. So how should we visualize the consequences of our decisions and actions within our context, within the context of an alternative dispute resolution, a mediation, a consensus building, even a seminar and a workshop, since we are teaching people how to do something, well, kind of a certain way, aren't we? Yes. So how should we visualize, what should we think about when we're thinking about the consequences of our decisions and actions? Oh, we actually have lots of participation. Let's see. A lot of people are saying by past experience. Yeah, it's a good way to think about what's going to happen in the future. When we think about what happened in the past when we did a thing like this, or when this exact thing was done somewhere else maybe. Yeah. What happened? What were the consequences? What occurred because of our actions? Yeah. What happened? So we'll look at past experience. Yes, thank you. Lots of folks are talking about the 5W questions. Yes, let's talk about those too. The 5W questions need to be asked, perhaps of ourselves and of someone who's going to be impacted or a group that's going to be impacted, right? The 5W questions are who, what, where, when, and why. Who, what, where, when, and why. And yes, we're gonna kind of get a list together of the topics we're going to cover, and then we'll do them one by one in a very practical manner because we like theory on this show. It's very nice. But we like to know what to do in the real world, what we can actually do that will make a difference. Yes. A lot of people talking about experts. We can visualize what the consequences will be by asking expert assistance. People are talking about surveys and focus groups. Yeah, that's expert assistance. I like this one too. A lot of folk are talking, we've got quite a few different topics to cover. A lot of folk are talking about inviting the affected groups to the process. Yeah, invite whoever's going to be affected to the table. Say, come on, let's talk about this. Let's involve you in the process and the decision making, and you can tell us what kind of effect this is going to have, right? Yeah, that's really very effective, right? And let's make our last one for today because we'll run out of time if we have like dozens. And this is a real good point too. A lot of folk are talking about what I'm going to call implementing gradually to assess the impact. Yeah, don't do it all at once. Do it in stages. Implement gradually to assess the impact. And then if you can see that something's going kind of, I don't like to say wrong, but having a negative impact in some way, you can modify, right? Right. Okay. So our first area that we're going to talk about is past experience. And, of course, we all get experiences in our lives, and we use them to go forward and to make decisions about what's going to happen next, don't we? Mm-hmm. Yes. Adrian and others are saying, Adrian says it's an analysis of prior decisions and actions and their impact, both pro and con. Yeah, past experience is an analysis of prior decisions and actions and their impact, both pro and con. Yes, we tend to think of impact in this particular context as kind of negative. Oops, that wasn't supposed to happen. But really, it could be positive. It could be fabulous and really help the entire world. I mean, this would be magnificent, right? Yeah, so impact is both pro and con. Yeah, I suppose that's true. Sometimes if something really, really benefits one group, it kind of doesn't benefit another one. It doesn't necessarily harm them, but they'd like to have benefit too, right? Yeah. Pardon me, took a sip of water. Yeah, so we're going to look to the past, and we're going to see what happened and the impact, both pro and con. Mm-hmm. Meryl is making a good point, too, that sometimes the past experience isn't our own. The experience is by other groups in other areas. We'll look to see what they did. The Internet's fabulous, isn't it? You can find out what's happening all over the world, never mind down the street. And you can look around and see, oh, this was what they did. And it was good. It was a positive impact. Oh, that seems good. That seems like a good idea, right? Yeah. And then we can go from there. Mm-hmm. So impact works in all directions, and we can look at what other groups in similar situations have done. Mm-hmm. You know what? Also, a lot of people are making this point, too. And, yes, we often say this. You know, of course, that an expert, because we've done programs on this, you want to hear prior shows, recipeforpeacenow.com. They're all archived there. And the thing is that not every expert has a degree in expertness, right? No. They are, even people have done it before. Done it in a different area, done it somewhere else. They're experts. We'd like to talk to them, right? Let's bring them into the process. Let's talk to them. Let's ask them how they did it. Let's ask them what the issues were. Let's ask them for advice. They'd love to, probably, because they're probably still interested in making an impact everywhere and not just in wherever they happen to be, right? Right. Yeah. So ask people what they did. They're the expert. They're the people that actually managed to do it. Fabulous. Yes. So other people's past experience is also valuable. Mm-hmm. And they're great experts. Yeah, they don't have to actually show up or anything. Skype exists. Mm-hmm. Kelia and others are saying that sometimes you have a similar situation with a past experience, but you need to be careful to understand and take into account the circumstances. Yes. Sometimes we say, oh, we've done this before. Yeah, but we know what to do. We've done this before. We've seen it before. We did it in a different state, for example, right? A different area. We've done this before. But that's complacency because every situation is different. Yeah, you take into account the circumstances, as Kelia says. Yes, and the circumstances are always a little different because you're dealing with people, and human beings are all different. Mm-hmm. And you might even be dealing with different regulations, different administration of some sort, right? Yeah, that's a good point. Different media. Mm-hmm. In the United States, for example, because we're a very big country, different parts of the United States react differently to things that seems like everybody would be on board, but not necessarily. There's kind of pockets of opinion that are very different. Yeah. Yeah, it is true. You see in the media that people say that there's left and right and red and blue, and I think that's too big a generalization. But there are areas of the country that are substantially more conservative than other areas. It just is. And, yeah, and so different, it looks like the same situation, but different circumstance. Different underlying belief system, maybe. Mm-hmm, yeah. And so you have to take that into account. The next theme we're going to talk about is after past experience. And we're going to move on to the 5W questions. Fabulous. Yes. How are we going to know what's happening and what the consequences might be if we don't ask? And the thing we need to ask is the 5W questions. Who, what, where, when, and why? Who, what, where, when, and why? Now, who are we going to ask these questions of? Well, how about ourselves, first of all, to gain understanding of the consequences? Yeah, let's think it through. Let's ask the 5W questions of ourselves. Usually we think of it as asking others, and we're going to. But let's ask it of us. Yeah. And then let's also ask it of the affected parties, right? Whoever's going to have a consequence from our decisions and actions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's include them if we possibly can. I'm real big on inclusion in the process. I think it really helps because then you get somebody's opinion, then you get their thoughts, then you get their past experiences, and maybe you think that they're helping them, that you're helping them, but you are not in their real world life, right? And you're not helping them in their opinion. They would like you to spend your effort and energy and decision-making and like that and tweak it so that it's something that will really benefit them, right? Yeah. You know, I see that in a lot of communities where do-gooders, well, I happen to be one of them, it's true. And you know, I'm a Rotarian. We've mentioned this before. And our motto is service above self. And before we go out and do a project, if I'm head of the committee, project in the community to help someone, I want to know if the community that we're headed out to help would like this help or would they like something else? Now, I am going to say something, and I hope my fellow Rotarians who are listening are not offended because I don't mean it to be. But for many, many years, Rotary, my Rotary Club, has spent money and effort and going out into the community to give dictionaries to grade schoolers. A book, a dictionary. We all know what a dictionary is. You look stuff up in it, how to spell, what the meaning is, right? Right, a dictionary. Actual physical book. This was invaluable years ago, because you needed to look stuff up. I looked up stuff in a dictionary. In fact, sometimes I still do. I still own a dictionary. But not very much anymore. It's like the phone book, right? Now, is there such a thing as a phone book? Yes. Do most of us actually ever look in one? Kind of iffy. I think they've discontinued making them, unless you specifically ask, maybe. Nobody has a phone book anymore because you look it up on the internet, right? You want to know how to spell something, you've got spell check, never mind look it up on the internet. You want to know what something, what the definition of a word is, well, don't you look it up on the internet? You don't go to a book in your backpack anymore, I don't think. And it was expensive and time-consuming and like that. And I said, why don't we ask the community that we're serving if that's something they're going to use? What a concept, right? And what they really could use is, of course, a small computer so they can look stuff up on the internet. Because even if they don't have internet in their home because it's expensive, the school has Wi-Fi. Pretty much the whole world has Wi-Fi. Yeah, that's what they'd really like. And now a computer is, of course, more expensive than a tablet or something. It's more expensive, or a little laptop is more expensive than a dictionary. But we could save up and do it once a year, maybe fewer people. We could partner with an organization that has refurbished, for example, right? Not so expensive to buy a refurbished one. We could partner with a big group like Microsoft, maybe, right? Yeah, there's lots of things we could do to get a practical, wonderful thing in the hands of a student to help them learn and go forward in school, right? Right. Yeah, and sometimes the good intentions and like that, it's not, we think it's good, but the recipient doesn't. They don't, it's not what they needed. It's not what they wanted. They think it's kind of dumb, for example. Yeah. So it's important to, for heaven's sakes, ask and include someone in the community that you are helping in the process. Right? Right. So let's do the who, what, where, when, and why. How about who? Who is affected? Yeah. Who's going to feel the consequences? What will happen to them? What kind of consequences are we talking about? What will be the outcome? Mm-hmm. Where will these consequences be most impactful? Yeah. Who, what, where? Where will it be most impactful? Who, what, where, when will the consequences occur? We have a time period. Mm-hmm. And why is this impact, this consequence probable? And why do we decide to do it this way? And why should we consider something else? Right? Yeah. Who, what, where, when, and why? Mm-hmm. Yes, this is a good point, too. Sharon and others are saying you need to determine how to have the consequential impact be positive. Yeah, that's the ticket. I mean, we don't want it to be a negative impact. We want it, or just a neutral one either. We've bothered to do something. We've spent a lot of time and effort. We've made decisions. We've reached consensus. We have acted upon it. It was something good that we wanted to do. And we want it to have positive impact, right? We want the consequences to be positive and not just kind of neutral or even negative, right? Yeah. So you need to determine how that is, how that could be. And for that, you need to talk to the people you're impacting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is a good point that Muhammad is making. Muhammad says you also need a secondary plan to assist those negatively impacted for the greater good. What an idea. Good point. You need to have a secondary plan to assist those negatively impacted for the greater good. Muhammad, that's a real good point. And greater good, you have to make sure that it is, right? And not just kind of our idea of the greater good, but it really helps a lot of people. And sometimes someone is negatively impacted. But a very small percentage compared to the positive impact for many, many, many more. And those who are negatively impacted, as Muhammad says, should have a secondary plan so they can be made whole, right? So that they can be compensated, so that they will not be kind of the losers in the bunch. Yeah, we want people to benefit all the way around. Mm-hmm. You know, Liz and others are making a good point about the use of the media to create a positive viewpoint and public opinion. This is so true. The question is, really, how do people know they've been negatively impacted? Yeah. Or positively impacted, if it's not real crystal clear, like monetary or something. Well, the media tell them, right? The media kind of create public opinion. And the media can sway the idea of this is good. Oh, I'm pleased. That seems good. Or that's terrible. You know, that we can't have that. We're going to go protest. Right? Yeah. You know, people are asking for an example because it seems kind of weird that the media can positively impact something. Okay. In my town, in my area, in my country maybe, but especially here, there are a lot of old buildings in the downtown core. Well, there used to be, and there are not so many anymore. But, and because the downtown, basically speaking, used to have blight. It was not a very good place. But then it got kind of renewed, and now downtown property is very desirable and very expensive per square foot. What I'm telling you is that a bunch of kind of abandoned, trashy, old four-story buildings that take up a whole block are now on prime real estate, and somebody buys the real estate and wants to tear them down. There is an historic commission that decides whether or not you can actually, what should be done with the space, what should be done with the building. Some of the buildings, sometimes people try to get on historic register protection, right? And the media has a play in that because it can be swayed, wow, it would be wonderful to have a new revitalized multi-use tower there. Wouldn't that be fab? Or they're ruining our history and our making everything in the downtown core look like a box, a big, tall box, right? Yeah, and so there's media sway there because it is true that, all right, and sometimes the developers kind of say that they will keep, which is very weird. What they do is they keep the facade from the outside, from the old building, which is truly had it today, right? And they keep like a shell that they build their building into, so that the very bottom of the big tall building has terracotta with cherubs type shell to it. Yeah, it's very strange, but it's kind of a compromise to keep the look on the bottom and build the multi-use fancy thing inside it. Yeah, it okay, I made it sound awful, but it's actually kind of interesting to do that. But there's commissions and stuff that are swayed by the media and by public opinion, which is swayed by the media, as to whether or not they should give the permit or they should think about it more carefully. Yeah. And so, but that's an example of media and public opinion making a difference into a consequence. Because I want to buy the property, but I can't use the thing that's on there now. And so as a consequence of my buying it, I want to tear it down, right? I'm not buying the building. I'm buying the land, the location. And so, yeah, and so whether or not I can do that might be swayed by public opinion. And whether the people are going to protest on the outside. And whether or not I have to make some sort of a design compromise is also public opinion. Yes, that's a very good point. Some of you are in my area. Fabulous. Yes. The answer is that just recently there was a land purchase in the downtown core, and a lot of the buildings came down on that piece of land because they were of no architectural significance. But a multinational developer purchased it for multi-use. It's fancy. It's going to have a fancy hotel and offices and maybe condos. I can't remember now. But on the parcel of land was a church, a mid-size, didn't take up a whole block or anything, very old, very traditional Methodist church with fancy windows, and you know what I mean, a church. And it was on the historic register because it was very, very old, very, very old in our parlance, which means that we're not in Europe, of course, where everything's like 700 years old, but it was like more than 100 years old. I can't remember how old the thing is. And in order to build their high-rise, they had to build around the church. They couldn't tear it down. And in order to build around the church, they had to shore up the foundation because we had an earthquake and it was kind of rickety. So it's kind of a win-win. There it is. It is decommissioned, if that's the right word. And they're going to use it as part of their hotel as a beautiful spot, as a beautiful, like a ballroom, because it's no longer a church. And in all truth and honesty, it hadn't been a church as in an active congregation for years since the earthquake, because it was it was seismically unsafe. But as a requirement to get all the permitting and stuff, they had to shore it up and make it a beautiful edifice and like that for people to admire. Yeah. So things happen, and public opinion, the media played an extreme role in that they couldn't just level it, even though it had been damaged in the earthquake and it was no longer an active congregational church. So there. Yeah, so public opinion is important when you're talking about consequences. Yeah, that made I suppose it's a desirable consequence for the city because it's an historic landmark, and an impactful consequence to the developers who had to agree to it because it's sitting on a chunk of land and they had to build around it and put in lots and lots of money, I'm certain, in seismic shoring up. Yeah, so the media creates positive and negative viewpoint. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's go on to our next topic, or we will run out of time. Mm-hmm. And that's the use of expert surveys and focus groups to find out what our consequences, the real-world impact of our decisions and actions will be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a good point. I have indeed seen this. A lot of you are going, surveys and focus groups are not a real effective way to learn just about anything. Excuse me. I've seen some, and we all have, that truly don't get to the bottom of what you want to know. And the broader the thing that you want to know, the probably less effective the survey. Mm-hmm. As Daria and others are saying, the survey needs to be carefully worded so you get a useful response. The survey needs to be carefully worded so you get a useful response. So true, right? Because you don't want a biased response. That's why you should indeed hire an expert. But you should make the expert tell you tell you the reasoning behind the survey questions, right? Yeah, because sometimes you hire an expert and you tell them what you want to know and they hear it not the way you intended it. Does that make any sense? Yeah, so the survey questions are not really what you want to know, so the answers aren't useful. I mean, really, what's the point of nagging people with a survey if the answers aren't going to be useful? And you really want to know something when you've got a survey. The same thing for focus groups, right? Mm-hmm. Well, this is true, too. Cheryl and others saying you also need an expert analysis of the results to prevent bias. Yeah, you need expert analysis of the results, especially if there's write-ins, right? And there's lots of choices. And I think it's interesting, if the survey is done properly, to have an analysis of the group, but an analysis of each survey also. Because the way people answer within each survey is indicative of what they're thinking and what they want, right? Yeah, and that makes a difference too. And that can all be, well, it all gets put on a spreadsheet, really. I mean, it's a computer thing. But if you asked questions, that really needs analysis, right? Yeah, and really thinking about it. Yes. The answer is, people are asking of questions. The answer is you can only, in my personal opinion, do that in a computer survey because you don't have handwriting. It's typed, right? So the answers are legible. I know that's a stupid thing to say, but that's really what it is. You want the answers to be legible so that you can go, oh, yeah, I gotcha, and not go, what on earth does that say? I have no idea. Oh, my. Yeah, that kind of stuff. So, yeah. So if you do it on a computer, which mostly they are, they're SurveyMonkey and like that. But I think it's terribly interesting to see an actual response. Mm-hmm. You need an expert to look at it. Yeah, Garrett and others are saying you're too close to the results to be impartial. I think that's true sometimes. It's not that we're bad people or anything, but we've been working on this a long time. And we have our own opinions and our own viewpoints, and we're pretty darn sure that we're right. I mean, Jesus, we've been looking at it forever, right? And maybe yes and maybe no to that being true, but we sure think it is. And that means that our survey, our answers and like that, will be read with that bias. Just not because we're biased people, but because that's our underlying basis, our underlying thought, right? So we need to have some third-party, impartial look at the survey results and interpret them. Mm-hmm. Because we're too close, as Garrett says. Mm-hmm. Suhagi says that the focus group participants need to be carefully chosen, too, to be certain that they represent the targeted group. Yes. We've all seen focus groups that, how shall I put this with delicacy and good taste, are not really focus groups, right? Because they don't really represent the people we're trying to reach. They see that in marketing a lot. Marketers actually make a lot of focus groups before they put out a product, for example. And you can have a focus group, but they have to be the right people. I mean, they have to have an opinion that is typical of their group, of where they came from, of why they were chosen. I think it's interesting if you're going to have an expert focus group made and developed, because I think a focus group could be just all the people that are going to be impacted, right? They're my focus group. They're the people who are going to feel the effects of our decisions and plans, right? That looks like a focus group to me. But if you're going to have an actual focus group put together out of different people from different communities, for example, I would be interested in asking about the interview process. I'd like to know where they're getting them. My one and only experience with focus group that was expertly done, and it was for a big money settlement and like that, and it was a good try. But I guess I ask questions a lot, but I wanted to know. I was not the person who was running it, because it wouldn't have looked like that if I was. And that's the honest God's truth, and that's why I have a real opinion about focus group due to past experience, right? But I learned something in my past experience. So I'm sitting there listening to a focus group, because I'm not really a part of it, but we're looking at it, and we're actually, because it was that fancy schmancy thing, we're actually behind two-way glass, right? And somebody's conducting the focus group, a professional organization, a professional focus group maker. You know what I mean? That's what they do, is they create focus groups and do marketing and like that, a marketing firm. And I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking about the leader who is leading definitely in a certain direction that the client thinks is right. Already we've got something wrong, right? Because I don't want you to just validate what I think if it's not something that should be validated. I mean, it's nice and everything, but I want you to tell me really what you think and not what you think I want to hear, which is two different things, right? Yeah. And so already I can see that the client, who was actually not my client, but the client wanted to hear something, and the focus group is being led that way. And then I'm looking at these people in the focus group, And I'm kind of wondering about them and wondering about their answers. Because their answers are kind of pat. You know what I mean? They're kind of practice sounding. And to me, a focus group is from the part. Yeah, you tell me something that is important to you, right? Yeah. And this thing is kind of weird. So I actually, during the break, I actually approached a couple of the focus group members. Probably just you know, we're having a snack just in the hallway. And I said, how were you chosen to be in this focus group? Because they looked fine and everything. I mean, they were all upright and stuff. How were you chosen? And you know what they said? You guys have actually seen this. I'm getting a response, and it's exactly right. They said, we come from an act company. We're actors. We are acting. We are pretending to be members of certain groups. We're actors. We were gotten from a talent agency. And I'm like, oh. Somebody told us which part to play, and that's what we're doing. But that's telling you nothing. That's telling you that these people are pretty good actors. Yep. People are asking if I actually told the client that. You know, I actually did. It was not a breach of confidentiality. It was just a fact that I had learned that impacted the efficacy of the focus group. Yeah, and I thought about it, and I thought, gee, I would like to know that. Mm-hmm. In fact, what I did was I told the client that it would be an interesting question to ask of the focus group participants how they became members of the focus group. And he said, yeah. I said, yeah, you'll be interested in the answer. Go ask them. Don't ask the people that put the focus group together, necessarily. Ask the participants how they became members of the focus group. And so he did. And so he found that out. And it was interesting to know, and the focus group ended because it wasn't telling us anything. What it was telling us was an opinion of the actor as to what their role, what their character would respond as. Well, now that's not useful. Yes, so it is my past experience that if you're going to hire an expert to make a focus group, ask them how they're interviewing. Ask them where the people are coming from, how they're getting the people. Mm-hmm. Because you've got some inherent bias no matter what. Yeah, this is true. You have some inherent bias depending on, for example, the time of day that the focus group is going during. If it's during business hours, then people with a job are kind of excluded. It makes a difference if people are being paid. And how much, whether it's a desirable thing because of the money, and you'll say anything in order to be asked back, right? Yeah, my favorite focus group is not experts, not expertly put together, like by a marketing company. My favorite type is the people who are going to be impacted. Yeah, and that's our next topic, yay team, to include the affected groups in the process. I think that's real important. And when people are included, groups are included, you know what we ask, what I always ask? Is there someone else we should include? Some other group, some other type of people that are going to be impacted that we haven't even thought of. Right? Yeah. Sometimes that happens. There's somebody who's going to be impacted and we don't realize it. But they're out there. And that's what I ask. I always say, is there someone else we should invite to the table? Someone else is going to feel an impact. Yeah. And a lot of times there is. And we go, wow, That's interesting. Didn't even think about you guys. Although we don't say that, of course, because it would be rude. Yeah, but we think it. Yeah. So clue the affected groups in the process. Yeah. Owen says that the best way to understand the consequences is to include those affected. Exactly. How are we going to? Because they will really understand the consequences. Because they're in it. They're doing it. Yeah, this is a good point. Hussein says you need to analyze the consequences so that you include everyone and don't get a skewed viewpoint. Yeah, good point, Hussein. That you need to analyze the consequences so that you include everyone and don't get a skewed viewpoint. It's true. Sometimes you think, well, these people are going to be affected. Let's invite them into the process. And we don't think about somebody else. And we think, oh, well, we've got it now. But it gives us a skewed viewpoint because these people, and they're not bad people or anything, it's just human nature, to say, look, we'd like it to go this way because it benefits us, because it would be good, right? Yeah. But the answer is that we need to look at everything and everyone to decide whether we've got all viewpoints or we're getting kind of a skewed bias, right? Yeah. You know, this is a good point. Elizabeth is saying that you have to ask everyone if there's anything else you're supposed to know, anybody else who should be included. And people are talking about anthropology. And, you know, one of the little premises, I don't know what you'd call it, the theories of anthropology, especially when anthropologists still today. I mean, there's not so much primitive anthropology, I don't think. But anthropology is still going into areas and helping people, right, and finding out what they need. And one of the things about anthropology, Margaret Mead, actually, she was like long ago. But, you know, she went into groups and she saw stuff and she kind of made decisions and analysis based on her past experience and her ideas, really. And she kind of made assumptions. And all anthropologists did this, at least originally. And when the assumptions turned out to be wrong, and it wasn't what she was looking at all, she said, how come you didn't tell me? And the response was, because you didn't ask. Right? Yeah. How come you didn't tell me that there was some sort of a consequence? How come you didn't tell me that there was another group that we should include? How come you didn't tell me that this had been done before and it had impacted them adversely? Yeah, how come you didn't tell me? And the answer is because you didn't ask. Try not to have that answer, because you didn't ask. Because you want to be inclusive. And you want to ask is what it really is. Yeah. So it's one of those, ask everybody if there's somebody else. So then when the consequences come, somebody doesn't come roaring out of the woodwork and go, look, you've hurt me. Ah, gee, we didn't know you existed. We didn't think about this consequence to you. Come and talk to us. Yeah. Which gets us to our last topic. Oh, I think we're going to run out of time. Oh, well, that's all right. Sometimes I'll try to make one recipe because I know you guys like it. Okay. And the last topic is to implement the consequences gradually. Implement the plan gradually. Yeah? Yeah. Suki and others are talking about the law of unintended consequences. Yes. I think it's an Americanism. It's kind of an expression. But this is the law of unintended consequences. It means that when you go to do something, when you've made decisions and taken action and doing something, somewhere along the line it's going to have a consequence that you didn't think about, probably. I mean, we're going to try to be careful and not have that happen, but there's a real good chance that it might, right? Yeah, it's the law of unintended consequences. And that's why you want to do stuff gradually. Because gradual implementation allows for modification, right? Uh-oh, that's not quite working the way we thought. Sometimes the unintended consequence, especially if what you've done is you have put something on the ballot, you have written a new law, you've put together a new regulation, something like that, sometimes the unintended consequence is that someone is injured. But also, the unintended consequence, it can be that it gets taken to court. And the courts interpret it, let's say, differently than you had in mind. Because you didn't think that wording was obscure or unclear or could be interpreted like that. But there we go. And it may, that's why you need someone else to read it, an expert, some third party, to read it, to think about it before you implement, because you're too close. You know how every word in that new regulation, law, whatever, was carefully hammered out and consensus and like that. And you're proud of it. But as an outsider, just reading it, what if I could interpret it in a way that you didn't intend at all? Right? Yeah, and that happens sometimes when things go to court. Pardon me. And they get interpreted completely differently. That's not what we meant. Well, that's what it says, and that's how an outsider would look at it. So, unintended consequences. Have someone read your stuff over and look at it. An impartial third party with an eye to detail and to interpretation. Yeah, very important. You know, this is a good point, too, that Thomas and others are making, that gradual implementation alerts groups who didn't realize that they were going to be impacted. Yeah, sometimes when you start to implement something, people go, oh, my God, I didn't know you were doing that. We're being impacted adversely. Well, they never complain if they're being impacted positively, let's face it. But, yeah, and you go, oh, we didn't even know about you. But good thing we implemented gradually, because come and talk to us and we'll modify. Yeah. So sometimes that's true, that the gradual implementation alerts groups who didn't realize they were going to be impacted. Yeah, they didn't realize that that's going to happen. Oh, my goodness. A lot of times it's like merchant groups and stuff like that. And they didn't realize it. They didn't think about the wording. They didn't think about the consequences to them. Right? Yeah. Yes, this is true to a lot of people using an environmental example, that a lot of times when there is some sort of environmental law change or some sort of a change that affects, I don't know, some sort of public lands or some sort of pollution laws and stuff like that, they're gradually implemented because just in case the impact is unforeseen, you want to be able to rectify the problem. Right? And they're very carefully monitored to make certain that things are going all right and that we're having the impact that we had hoped for. Right? Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so now we're going to go on to the recipe because it helps us to have impact, to have a convivial atmosphere in the group so that we can make these decisions, so that we can take these actions, so that we can reach consensus. And one of the ways we create the convivial atmosphere is to have some food in the room. We need a break. We need a time out. We're hungry. We need to do something together that will not annoy us, right? And give us a chance to take 3 deep breaths and breathe. We need a chance for the leader to maybe quietly talk with somebody outside of in front of the group, right? Yeah, in any event, it's a good, nice thing to do, to have a break, and allows all kinds of, well, necessary activities to go on. So we're going to have some food in the room. It also keeps people in the room and not wandering off. And then you have to herd them back in, because they've gone looking for a candy bar is what they've gone. So we're going to have some food in the room. We're going to, and if we're going to do that, we're going to take a survey, which we're going to disseminate. And the survey is going to ask if anybody has any allergies, food prohibitions, or religious prohibitions to some sort of food. We're going to pass that around because we don't want anybody to have a bad time. Also, when people bring something, we'd like them to bring a list with it, not just saying what it is, but saying what is in it, so that I can run my eye down it and know if I can eat it or not. Right? Right. I also think that the leader should bring at least one safe recipe, that being something that would be very usual for my people to eat. They'd have eaten it before. And we've taken the survey, of course, and people are comfortable eating it. I think you can sometimes have an adventure recipe. Now, not if somebody in the participants has said they're allergic to something. That's not an adventure recipe. That's just rude. But the adventure recipe has ingredients that my people might not be familiar with. They might not have eaten them before. And we've taken the survey, but we want to make sure that everybody knows, for example, that it has fish in it, right? Right. Because we've got time for, I think, one recipe, and we're going to do the adventure one, because last week we did the safe one, and I'm trying to keep track, because if I don't, you guys call me out on it. And so this is a fish chowder. I like this kind of a thing. I make it very, very thick, and I serve it with rice on the side, because I think it's kind of like a fish stew. You can make it more liquidy and make it into a chowder. I like it more thick, and I make it into a stew. When I have something with fish in it, just in case someone doesn't want to eat fish, I put a big sign, and I put a nice big chunk of fish on the outside of it, on the rim, so that everybody can see it, that it's fish. And I put fish in very big letters because sometimes people haven't mentioned something. They can't eat fish or can't eat that kind of fish. So here we go. We're going to have 2 pounds of some sort of firm fish. I like to kind of mix it up a little, like a half pound each. We could even have 3 pounds. I like a lot of fish. If I'm going to make fish chowder, I like to see fish. So let's have 3 pounds. Something frozen, skinless, boneless, in fillets that we're going to cut into chunks, right? You want to use fresh, fabulous. Be sure and get the bones out. If you're going to use frozen, and I'm afraid there's a good chance that I am, it's more convenient and cheaper, you need to thaw it and pat it dry, right? Right. Mm-hmm. I also like to rinse them underwater. I'm not sure why, I just do. Let's have a couple of medium onions. I like the sweet ones that we're going to chop. They're called Vidalias out here. Mm-hmm. Let's have about 4 cloves of garlic that we're going to mince. You think I use too much garlic? Use less. Hmm? We've got 3 pounds of fish. I think it'll be okay. Let's have a couple tablespoons of olive oil. Maybe you could use butter, too, if you like. Mm-hmm. Let's have 2 cups of chicken broth. You can use fish stock if you want, which if you have, that's very lovely. I think the commercial fish stock's a little tinny tasting, and I like chicken broth, chicken stock better. Hmm? Let's have a tablespoon of lemon juice. Let's have a bay leaf, which we're going to remember to fish out if we're smart. I'm going to use 2 large cans of whole tomatoes that I'm going to rough chop, and I'm going to drain them real carefully. If you want to use fresh tomatoes, that would be nice too. Slice them up. The thing that goes best in a chowder like this is the little ones, called Romas, I think. Yeah, even the grape ones that you turn it. I must confess that I think the canned one is better. I know that that's kind of peasanty, because it doesn't lose its seeds and get kind of piece of skin with no seeds. Does that make sense? Yeah, so I'm going to use 2 large, like 16-ounce cans, drained and rough chopped of the whole ones. If you use fresh tomatoes, that would be lovely too. But kind of do something that stays together. Does that make sense? Okay, we're going to thaw the fish. We're going to rinse it. We're going to pat it dry. We're going to cut it into chunks. Right? Right. Now let's take our oil in a nice big saucepan. You could use butter also. And let's cook the onion and the garlic until they're nice and tender. We're going to stir in, because we've got a nice big pot, right? We're going to stir in the chicken stock, the lemon juice. We're going to throw in the bay leaf. Let's throw in a little bit of thyme, too. I like about a half teaspoon of crushed time. You can put in that big sprig thing, but then you have to try to fish it out along with the bay leaf, and I have enough trouble finding the bay leaf. And we're going to bring this whole thing to a boil, right? Yeah, because the fish doesn't need to be in there yet. We don't want it to fall apart. We've got it all boiling. It's got onions. It's got garlic. It's got all kinds of nice herbs, the bay leaf, the thyme, the lemon juice. Now we're going to add the fish and the tomatoes if we're using raw. The fish first and then the tomatoes if we're not. Go to turn it to boiling. Let's reduce the heat, cover and simmer. Oh, 10 minutes until the fish flakes, right? Yeah. You can put in the tomatoes when you cover it, when you reduce the heat and cover it, because they're going to be just fine and they're not cold. So what we're doing is we're not cooking the fish, right? We want it to be cooked through and we want it to flake easily. This is delicious. Serve it with rice on the side. Yeah, you want to make it a little thinner, put less fish. I make it very, very thick. I called it a chowder, but what we're really looking at is fish and tomato stew, aren't we? Yeah. And it is delicious. It's easy to do. You might even, if you prepped the fish and everything, because there's not much prep in this, right? There's some mincing and of the garlic and the onion and like that, and some cutting into chunks. If you get that kind of prepped or you have room to do it in the room, it smells really nice when it's boiling because of the herbs and the garlic and the onion. You might even do it right in the room with everybody watching because people are interested. They like to learn how to cook something, right? Right. A little messier than sometimes because it's got fish, but if you're careful, I think it would be kind of a nice thing. And it smells delightful. Yes. Mm-hmm. So that's our fish chowder. It is easy to make, kind of economical. And it is our adventure recipe because we have used fish in it. And not everybody, you have to tell what kind of fish it is, too. Yeah. Yes, the answer is yes. People are asking about different kinds of seafood. And the answer is yes, but you do know that things like shrimp, you can't simmer for the 10 minutes because they go rubbery. They are a maybe about a 5 minutes. You have to look at them until they get translucent and kind of, well, until they, not really, they're no longer translucent. They turn white like shrimp are supposed to do. And yes, you can add all kinds of seafood into this if you would like. I'm scared to say yes to that question. People are asking if it would be a good dish to use leftovers in. I suppose, but I'm not going to advocate it because I think fish is perishable and shrimp is perishable. And I'm not certain that you should use it the next day. I'm really not, especially if it has sat out for any length of time unrefrigerated. You're going to have to be the judge of that. Of course, if it's already pre-cooked, you don't cook it as long because you're not trying to, you're just making it hot all the way through. You're going to have to judge the storage on that. And if you're sure that you can serve it the next day, it's not going to make anybody sick. Yeah. But if you do such a thing, of course, you would boil the you would simmer the fish much less time because it's already cooked, right? What you're doing is you're heating everything through. Yeah. Yeah, I'm always scared to say yes to leftovers. Anyway, thank you, my friends. Our time is almost up. Thank you for being here. Thank you for coming. Thank you for all of your participation. If you would like to contact us, we're at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. The website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Prior shows, they're archived on our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. Thank you for all of your participation. And please do come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.